Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Brothers Karamazov, Book 6, Chapter 2, Part B. We've got a little discussion going on, and then we'll be reading Part C. The only question I asked you guys about Part B was this. So, Zosima is into the Bible in a big way. Cool. Any of the stories he mentioned seem particularly relevant. I Am Norwegian said this chapter brings up the story of Job. Jung had an interesting take on this in his book, Answer to Job. In the book, he argues that the book of Job reveals another side to God. What Jung proposes as the fourth element of the Trinity, the quaternity, really, which is the evil face of God, his shadow, so to speak. In the book, Jung turns God sending his son to earth to die for our sins into God sending his son to earth to atone for his own sins. It's a complete reversal. Jung is also special in arguing that God was something of a narcissist. Yahweh is no friend of critical thoughts, which in any way diminish the tribute of recognition he demands. Yahweh needs the acclamation of a small group of people. One can imagine what would happen if this assembly suddenly decided to stop the applause. There would be a destructive rage. Then a withdrawal into hellish loneliness and the torture of non-existence, followed by a gradual reawakening of an unutterable longing for something which would make him conscious of himself. And it is as if he existed only by reason of the fact that he has an object which assures him that he is really there. Jung predictably looks at this through the lens of psychology. Only when God as Christ dies on the cross does he gain full understanding and empathy for human pain and suffering. Zizek, in the debate I linked in this subreddit yesterday, mentioned something interesting about Jesus on the cross. Jesus said, "Father, why have thou forsaken me?" And Zizek made the point that this is God losing faith in himself, God for a moment turning atheist. This seems to fit with what Jung is saying here, God gaining full understanding of human struggles, including pervasive doubt. It's a very controversial book. Jung himself described it as pure poison, but it is interesting. I'm not sure how most Christians or Jews defend God in relation to Job, but it's interesting to see Jung taking a firmer stance than forget the literal words and look at what it really means and represents. Soma Stars said, interesting to hear the Book of Job interpreted and analysed in this manner. It's been a while since I read it myself, but the takeaway I recall of the book is that you can do good things and be a truly good person, and God/life can still shit on you. Yet Job never loses his faith. Even in the end, he still praises God. The story is often presented from that angle, that Job's faith is not shaken despite what he goes through. I suspect Zosima cherishes it for that reason, since he sees so many people of shaky faith coming to him and begging for blessings. Side note, I thought it was interesting, and not at all surprising, that Dostoy attacked Lutherans in this chapter. Looks like it's not just Catholics and that he hates. I Am Norwegian said yes, but it seems that the more literally you take the story of Job, the harder it becomes to stomach. God won the bet, but he still bet with a human life and made Job suffer greatly to prove a point. The more I think about it, the more the developmental perspective makes sense. He is a theological illustration. Oh, what's this little link here? Let me see if I can describe this picture that's been linked by I Am Norwegian. Okay. I think I can describe this. It says, God in the Old Testament, and there's a picture of SpongeBob SquarePants with huge muscles and a like sweatband around his head looking very mean. And then God in the New Testament, and there's a picture of SpongeBob who's all round with big shiny eyes, and he looks like even friendlier than SpongeBob usually does. And then at the bottom it says, "Forgive them, Father." I don't know what that means, but it made me laugh. Thanks for the illustration there, I Am Norwegian. Norwegian continues, "Of course, there is some truth to the notion that you shouldn't lose faith just because you have faced difficulty and suffering, even if it is horrible. There is a good medical literature correlating sick people who have poor outlooks who have essentially given up as dying much more quickly than those who have hope and faith in the future. Man, sorry, I can't read tonight. And there are tons of examples of people who have survived impossible odds because they kept pushing on. I think Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning wrote about how it was the people who lose faith that died, not faith in God particular, but they lost hope and seemed to let themselves die. Hmm. A bit of a hard claim to substantiate, because the people who were very, very hopeful and never lost hope but died didn't remain to tell that story. So there could be equally amount of people who were very hopeful and were certain that they would get better and it was just a bump in the road and all that, and then didn't pull through. Kind of hard to quantify. Techrific said, the more I think about it, the more the developmental perspective makes sense. Well, at least there was no hell in the Old Testament. Forgiveness up to a point in the New Testament. Also, let's not forget those unfortunate enough to be born in the lands where the good news has not yet reached them. It's hell for them. God in the New Testament has some improving to do. Okay, there's a debate about whether that statement is correct. Sigh. Your statement about those who have not heard the good news go to hell is not true. The link below explains why. Okay, and then there's an ensuing debate. The different branches of Christianity, Lutherans, Russian Orthodoxies, etc., they've got different stances on whether or not that's true. The good news is that none of them are true, so don't worry about it too much. It's not worth arguing about. Techrific said, I shouldn't be surprised that the first time, not counting the illustrated children's version of the Bible, Zosima really reads the Bible, that is, it's the Book of Job. God as the experimenter with a human subject. Now reading the Book of Job is painful and upsetting. It challenges all your sense of human decency and ethics. The fact that so much emphasis is put on suffering, and in the case of Job, needless suffering, because God and the devil is basically having a little friendly wager among themselves over a poor guy's entire existence, just to prove a point, should shake us to the core. Now, the fact that such a decent man as Zosima can take away information from that horror show is a testament to human ingenuity, empathy, and cognitive dissonance. Later on in this part, I think, we reach a crux point. My life is approaching its end, I know that, I can sense it, but I feel that with each remaining day, my earthly life is drawing ever closer to the new, the infinite. My soul leaps with ecstasy, my mind becomes lucid, and my heart weeps for joy. Some detractors would say it's a death cult. I would disagree, but for all its sophistication, it always comes back to this dream of a life ever after. The promise of a paradise where justice will prevail. I deeply understand faith that comes from this place. This sense of injustice, the plight of the sufferers, the promised land for the good, but it's also a deeply problematic idea that has often been used directly to control the masses, to keep the humble, meek and pliant in the face of massive grievances, intolerable injustice, slavery and general oppression. If all is to be settled in the hereafter, what need of real justice is there in here and now? Yeah, that bit about him having that final burst of lucidity and ecstasy, even though he's growing weaker. If you ask me, I'm 100% certain that Dosto just put that in because he wanted to have a big, long rant from Zosima's point of view. He wanted him to sort of, you know, rant out his entire life, his entire core to his belief system, and explain it at length and in great detail and really go in depth about it. But he was aware that, you know, if you're on your deathbed, you're probably not going to have the energy to do that realistically. But he wanted to still do it anyway because he's a bad writer and he can't really, like, tell a story without someone just... Like, he can't express a character without that character just expressing themselves through words. There's no real part of this book so far where a character has displayed their human traits rather than just told us about them. And so Dosto wanted to have this huge rant, but was aware, like, oh, well, he's on his deathbed. He's probably not just going to sit there and, like, tell all this really clear and clean narrative about his life. So he's covered his ass in a few ways. There's the firstly that bit he said about, like, oh, these are Alyosha's notes, and he filled in bits and he got rid of the gaps and the interruptions, and he he might have filled in details with other stuff that he knew about his life. Just basically being like, oh, I want to write this in a way that he wouldn't have said it on his deathbed. And now as well, again, he's like doubling up on that and being like, oh, and by the way, he had this huge burst of lucidity and heaps of energy and ecstasy, and his heart was full of joy. And that's why he was able to explain everything so clearly and in such detail, even though he was very, very close to dying. It's just the author covering up, like making excuses for the fact that what he's doing doesn't make sense when you think about it. He's just sort of covering up that. In short, it's a really, really bad book written by a terrible author. And all I can see all through it is just the author doing bad writing and then covering up, like coming up with excuses for, oh, but yeah, this was, yeah, I'll just explain it in this way. That'll be fine. No, people will accept that. Even to the point where it's like, yeah, it is bad writing, but it's not because I just dictated it to someone else and they wrote it down and I couldn't be bothered actually writing. It's meant to be that way. I was trying to do an impression of provincial writers. Yeah, that's it. Oh, what's that? You wouldn't say a big long rant on your deathbed? Oh, well, here's five or six reasons why he might have. Yeah, okay, can we bend the truth a little bit there and suspend disbelief still? That's really the only thing I can see with that explanation. I think anything beyond that is you're just kind of lending Dosso like a little bit of like, oh no, he's such a good writer, he wouldn't do something like that. I think by this last book he'd kind of lost his thing. I don't know. I must be wrong, because everyone, like, I don't know. For every 10 five-star reviews, well, for every 100 five-star reviews, there's a one-star review. And so I'm in the, like, the 1%, but I just cannot see it anyway, like, other way. It's just so blatant to me. Anyway, sorry for the rant. I just hate this book. Techrific said, side note, as a mod of r/Hermann Hesse, I did not know you were a mod of r/Hermann Hesse. I'm very biased, but since you asked, Ander, in some ways I wish we were reading The Glass Bead Game. It's an incredible book. Who said Steppenwolf was his worst book? Who did say that? I don't know, I've heard that around. I've just heard that sort of from people who love Siddhartha will say they don't love Steppenwolf, and Siddhartha is his most famous, most popular book. I didn't like Siddhartha though. I found it a bit condescending. Steppenwolf, I love. It's in my top five books. Big influence as well on the book I'm writing now. Very different stylistically and plot-wise. It's different in a lot of ways, but Steppenwolf was certainly very influential on the book I'm writing now. Tech, I'll have to send you a copy of my third book when it's ready, because if you're a Hermann Hesse fan, maybe might have some crossover for you. Not that I would ever compare myself to someone as good as Hermann Hesse at writing, but hey, I can tell you one thing, I'm a lot better at writing than Dostoevsky. Like, I don't, that sounds like a massive boast, but honestly, I couldn't write a book better than Notes from Underground. Okay, I'll give you that. That was a great book. But this book, this version of this book we're reading now, I can say without any doubt I can write a better book. With no doubt in my mind. Like, if I can't write a better book than what we've been reading for the last couple of months, then I give up. I'll just say that. I will quit. I'll straight up quit writing, because this is a terrible book. Who said Steppenwolf was his worst book? Yeah, I just heard it around. No one in particular. First of all, that's not saying much, since Hesse is such a good author. Secondly, it's all subjective. I really liked it too. The message that you should be able to laugh at yourself is solid advice, as far as I'm concerned. Anyways, I highly recommend The Glass Bead Game. It's a synthesis of all the strains that Hesse explored in his other books. Well, that sounds interesting. Neal Stephenson even tried to emulate it in some ways in his book Anathem. So if you liked Anathem, you'd probably like The Glass Bead Game too. I've never read Neal Stephenson. Any Neal Stephenson. I haven't read Anathem. Haven't heard of them, to be honest. But I liked Steppenwolf a lot, so maybe I'll give it a shot. The Glass Bead Game. Cool. That's the conversation. Sorry for the rantiness today. I'm me. Herman Hess, r/Herman Hess, has 10 subscribers. 10 subscribers. How is that possible? For one of the greatest writers, his subreddit has 10 subscribers. That is insane to me. He wrote a lot of books. I'm just looking now. Wow. And he was active for a good, 80 years. Damn. Very cool. I'm going to subscribe. Done. All right. Laura Y. Stitch said, just now, just got in time, Laura Y. Stitch. I just saw this message drop in. Parts A and B have both been about Zosima finding faith in unlikely places. First, his non-believer brother. Next, in one of the more violent and difficult books in the Bible. I'm interested in what more we'll learn about this strange monk in the following parts. Very cool. All right, let's do a little reading, hey? This is part C. Called Recollections of Father Zosima's Youth Before He Became a Monk, The Duel. I spent a long time, almost 8 years, in the military cadet school at Petersburg, and in the novelty of my surroundings there, many of my childish impressions grew dimmer, though I forgot nothing. I picked up so many new habits and opinions that I was transformed into a cruel, absurd, almost savage creature. A surface polish of courtesy and society manners I did acquire, together with the French language. But we all, myself included, looked upon the soldiers in our service as cattle. I was perhaps worse than the rest in that respect, for I was so much more impressionable than my companions. By the time we left the school as officers, we were ready to lay down our lives for the honour of the regiment. But no one of us had any knowledge of the real meaning of honour, and if anyone had known it, he would have been the first to ridicule it. Drunkenness, debauchery, and devilry were what we almost prided ourselves on. I don't say that we were bad by nature. All these young men were good fellows, but they behaved badly, and I worst of all. What made it worse for me was that I had come into my own money, and so I flung myself into a life of pleasure, and I plunged headlong into all the recklessness of youth. I was fond of reading, yet strange to say, the Bible was the one book I never opened at that time, though I always carried it about with me, and I was never separated from it. In very truth, I was keeping that book for the day and the hour, for the month and the year, though I knew it not. After 4 years of this life, I chanced to be in the town of K, where our regiment was stationed at the time. We found the people of the town hospitable, rich, and fond of entertainments. I met with a cordial reception everywhere, as I was of a lively temperament, and was known to be well off, which always goes a long way in the world, and then a circumstance happened which was the beginning of it all. I formed an attachment to a beautiful, intelligent young girl of noble and lofty character, the daughter of people much respected. They were well-to-do people of influence and position. They always gave me a cordial and friendly reception. I fancied that the young lady looked on me with favour, and my heart was aflame at such an idea. Later on I saw and fully realised that I perhaps was not so passionately in love with her at all, but only recognised the elevation of her mind and character, which I could not indeed have helped doing. I was prevented, however, from making her an offer at the time by my selfishness. I was loath to part with the allurements of my free and licentious bachelor life in the heyday of my youth, and with my pockets full of money. I did drop some hint as to my feelings, however, though I put off taking any divisive step for a time. Then, all of a sudden, we were ordered off for 2 months to another district. On my return 2 months later, I found the young lady already married to a rich neighbouring landowner, a very amiable man, still young, though older than I was, connected with the best Petersburg society, which I was not, and of excellent education, which I was also not. I was so overwhelmed at this unexpected circumstance that my mind was positively clouded. The worst of it all was that, as I learned then, the young landowner had been a long while betrothed to her, and I had met him indeed many times in her house, but blinded by my conceit, I had not noticed anything. And this particularly mortified me. Almost everybody had known all about it, while I knew nothing. I was filled with sudden, irrepressible fury. With flushed face, I began recalling how often I had been on the point of declaring my love to her, and as she had not attempted to stop me or to warn me, she must, I concluded, have been laughing at me all the time. Later on, of course, I reflected and remembered that she had been very far from laughing at me. On the contrary, she used to turn off any lovemaking on my part with a jest and begin talking of other subjects, but at that moment I was incapable of reflecting and was all eagerness for revenge. I am surprised to remember that my wrath and revengeful feelings were extremely repugnant to my own nature. For being of an easy temper, I found it difficult to be angry with anyone for long, and so I had to work myself up artificially and became, at last, revolting and absurd. I waited for an opportunity and succeeded in insulting my rival in the presence of a large company. I insulted him on a perfectly extraneous pretext, jeering at his opinion upon an important public event. It was in the year 1826. My jeer was, so people said, clever and effective. Then I forced him to ask for an explanation, and behaved so rudely that he accepted my challenge in spite of the vast inequality between us, as I was younger, a person of no consequence, and of inferior rank. I learned afterwards for a fact that it was from a jealous feeling on his side also that my challenge was accepted. He had been rather jealous of me on his wife's account before their marriage. He fancied now that if he submitted to be insulted by me and refused to accept my challenge, and if she heard of it, she might begin to despise him and waver in her love for him. I soon found a second in a comrade, an ensign of our regiment. In those days, though duels were severely punished, yet dueling was a kind of fashion among the officers, so strong and deeply rooted with all will a brutal prejudice sometimes be. It was the end of June, and our meeting was to take place at 7 o'clock the next day on the outskirts of town, and then something happened that in very truth was the turning point of my life. In the evening, returning home in a savage and brutal humour, I flew into a rage with my orderly, a fancy, and gave him 2 blows in the face with all my might so that it was covered with blood. He had not long been in my service, and I had struck him before, but never with such ferocious cruelty. And believe me, though it's 40 years ago, I recall it now with shame and pain. I went to bed and slept for about 3 hours. When I waked up, the day was breaking. I got up. I did not want to sleep any more. I went to the window, opened it. I looked out upon the garden. I saw the sun rising. It was warm and beautiful. The birds were singing. What's the meaning of it? I thought. I feel in my heart as if it were something vile and shameful. Is it because I am going to shed blood? No, I thought. I feel it's not that. Can it be that I am afraid of death? Afraid of being killed? No, that's not it. That's not it at all. And all at once, I knew what it was. It was because I had beaten a fantasy the evening before. It all rose before my mind. It was all, as it were, repeated over again. He stood before me and I was beating him straight on the face, and he was holding his arms stiffly down, his head erect, his eyes fixed upon me as though on parade. He staggered at every blow and did not even dare to raise his hands to protect himself. That is what a man has been brought to, and that was a man beating a fellow creature. What a crime. It was as though a sharp dagger had pierced me right through. I stood as if I were struck dumb. While the sun was shining, the leaves were rejoicing, and the birds were trilling the praise of God. I hid my face in my hands, fell on my bed, and broke into a storm of tears. And then I remembered by Brother Markel and what he said on his deathbed to his servants, "My dear ones, why do you wait on me? Why do you love me? Am I worth your waiting on me?" "Yes, I am worth it," flashed through my mind. "After all, what I am worth for another man, a fellow creature made in the likeness and image of God, should serve me." For the first time in my life, this question forced itself upon me. He had said, "Mother, my little heart, in truth, we are each responsible to all for all. It's only that men don't know this. If they knew it, the world would be a paradise at once." God, can that too be false? I thought as I wept. In truth, perhaps, I am more than all others responsible for all, a greater sinner than all men in the world. And all at once the whole truth in its full light appeared to me. What was I going to do? I was going to kill a good, clever, noble man who had done me no wrong, and by depriving his wife of happiness for the rest of her life I should be torturing and killing her too. I lay thus in my bed with my face in the pillow, heedless how the time was passing by. Suddenly my second, the ensign, came in with the pistols to fetch me. "Ah," said he, "it's a good thing you're up already. It's time we were off. Come on." I did not know what to do and hurried to and fro undecided. We went out to the carriage, however. "Wait here a minute," I said. "I'll be back directly. I've forgotten my purse." And I ran back alone to Afanasy's little room. "Afanasy," I said, "I gave you 2 blows on the face yesterday. Forgive me." He started as though he were frightened and looked at me, and I saw that it was not enough, and on the spot, in my full officer's uniform, I dropped at his feet and bowed my head to the ground. "Forgive me," I said. Then he was completely aghast. "Your honour, sir, what are you doing? Am I worth it?" And he burst out crying, as I had done before, hid his face in his hands, turned to the window, and shook all over with his sobs. I flew out to my comrade and jumped into the carriage. "Ready?" I cried. "Have you ever seen the Conqueror?" I asked him. "Here is one before you." I was in ecstasy, laughing and talking all the way. I don't remember what about. He looked at me. "Well, brother, you are a plucky fellow. You'll keep up the honour of the uniform, I can see." So we reached the place and found them there waiting for us. We were placed 12 paces apart. He had the first shot. I stood gaily, looking him full in the face. I did not twitch an eyelash. I looked lovingly at him, for I knew what I would do. His shot grazed my cheek and ear. "Thank God," I cried. "No man has been killed." And I seized my pistol, turned back and flung it far away into the wood. "That's the place for you," I cried. I turned to my adversary. "Forgive me, young fool that I am, sir," I said, "for my unprovoked insult to you and for forcing you to fire at me. I am 10 times worse than you, and more, maybe. Tell that to the person whom you hold dearest in the world." I had no sooner said this than they all three shouted at me. "Upon my word," cried the adversary, annoyed, "if you did not want to fight, why did you let me alone? Why did not you let me alone?" "Yesterday I was a fool, today I know better," I answered him gaily. "As to yesterday, I believe you, but as for today, it is difficult to agree with your opinion," said he. "Bravo," I cried, clapping my hands, "I agree with you there too, I have deserved it. Will you shoot, sir, or not?" "No, I won't," I said. "If you like, fire at me again. If you like, fire at me again, but it could be better for you not to fire." The seconds, especially mine, were shouting too, "Can you disgrace the regiment like this, facing your antagonist and begging his forgiveness? If I'd only known this." I stood facing them all, not laughing now. "Gentlemen," I said, "is it really so wonderful in these days to find a man who can repent of his stupidity and publicly confess his wrongdoing?" "But not in a duel," cried my second again. "That's what's so strange," I said, "for I ought to have owned my fault as soon as I got here, before he had fired a shot, before leading him into a great and deadly sin. But we have made our life so grotesque that to act in that way would have been almost impossible. For only after I had faced his shot at the distance of 12 paces could my words have had any significance for him. And if I had spoken before, he would have said, 'He is a coward. The sight of the pistols has frightened him. No use to listen to him.' Gentlemen," I cried suddenly, speaking straight from my heart, "look around you at the gifts of God, the clear sky, the pure air, the tender grass, the birds. Nature is beautiful and sinless, and we are sinful and foolish, and we don't understand that life is heaven, for we have only to understand that it will at once be fulfilled in all its beauty. We shall embrace each other and weep." I would have said more, but I could not. My voice broke with the sweetness and youthful gladness of it, and there was such bliss in my heart as I had never known before in my life. "All this is rational and edifying," said my antagonist, "and in any case you are an original person." "You may laugh," I said to him, laughing too, "but afterwards you will approve of me." "I am already to approve of you now," said he. "Will you shake hands, for I believe you are genuinely sincere?" "No," I said, "not now, later on when I have grown worthier, and I deserve your esteem. Then shake hands, and you will do well." We went home, my second upbraiding me all the way while I kissed him. All my comrades heard of the affair at once and gathered together to pass judgment on me the same day. "He has disgraced the uniform," they said. "Let him resign his commission." Some stood up for me. "He faced the shot," they said. "Yes, but he was afraid of his other shot and begged for forgiveness. If he had been afraid of being shot, he would have shot his own pistol first before asking forgiveness, while he flung it loaded into the forest. No, there's something else in this, something original." I enjoyed listening and looking at them. "My dear friends and comrades," said I, "don't worry about my resigning my commission, for I have done so already. I have sent in the papers this morning, and as soon as I get my discharge I shall go into a monastery. It's with that object I am leaving the regiment." When I had said this, every one of them burst out laughing. "You should have told us that first. That explains everything. We can't judge a monk." They laughed and could not stop themselves, and not scornfully, but kindly and merrily. They all felt friendly to me at once, even those who had been sternest in their censure, and all the following month, before my discharge came, they could not make enough of me. "Ah, you monk," they would say, and everyone said something kind to me. They began trying to dissuade me, even to pity me. "What are you doing to yourself?" "No," they would say, "he is a brave fellow. He faced fire and could have fired his own pistol, but he had a dream the night before that He should become a monk, that's why he did it. It was the same thing with the society of the town. Till then I had been kindly received, but had not been the object of special attention, and now all came to me at once and invited me. They laughed at me, but they loved me. I may mention that although everybody talked openly of our duel, the authorities took no notice of it because my antagonist was a near relation of our general, and as there had been no bloodshed and no serious consequences, and as I resigned my commission, they took it as a joke. And I began then to speak aloud and fearlessly regardless of their laughter, for it was always kindly and not spiteful laughter. These conversations mostly took place in the evenings, in the company of ladies. Women particularly liked listening to me then, and they made the men listen. But how can I possibly be responsible for all? Everyone would laugh in my face. Can I, for instance, be responsible for you? You may well not know it, I would answer, since the whole world has long been going on a different line, since we consider the various lies as truth, and demand the same lies from others. Here I have for once in my life acted sincerely, and well, you all look upon me as a madman. Though you are friendly to me, yet you see you all laugh at me. But how can we help being friendly to you? Said my hostess, laughing. The room was full of people. All of a sudden the young lady rose, on whose account the duel had been fought, and whom only lately I had intended to be my future wife. I had not noticed her coming into the room. She got up, came to me, and held out her hand. Let me tell you, she said, that I am the first not to laugh at you, but on the contrary, I thank you with tears and express my respect for you for your action then. Her husband, too, came up, and then they all approached me and almost kissed me. My heart was filled with joy, but my attention was especially caught by a middle-aged man who came up to me with the others. I knew him by his name already, but had never made his acquaintance, nor exchanged a word with him till that evening. All right, there we go. That's part C. Zossima turns out to be, well, when he was younger at least, a bit of a hooligan and kind of an asshole. Have your say over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I look forward to seeing what you've got to say. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.